Starry regards once again to all aspiring celesticians. And anyone else disposed to listen, either in the time that I make these recordings or in the times to come. This is John Lash teaching Celestics on the 1st of February, 2014. Celestic Talk number 13, The Planetary Vision Quest. Today, or yesterday to be precise, was the first day of the shift of Matangi. And let me check my calendar here. Yes, indeed. The 30th of January was the completion of the Kali shift that kicked off the year. And today is the second day of the Matangi shift, the 1st of February. And tomorrow is the first day of spring, according to the Gaian calendar. Now, usually I discuss such matters, such parameters of timing, connected to the Shakti cluster, in the context of my talks for the GNE. But I'm mixing a little bit of it in here, a little bit of GNE intel in the introduction to this this talk on Celestics. Why am I doing that? Because the subject, the Planetary Vision Quest, relates intimately to one of the figures in the Shakti cluster, the Mahavidya, known as Matangi. And she is correlated to the constellation of the Manitou. So, as I've explained in previous talks, it took me many years to work out the figures of these constellations. The graphics that you now see are relatively finished. There have been many earlier versions and drafts. But ultimately, they can never be finished. As Rilke said, no true work of art can ever be completed. It can only be abandoned at the right moment. Well, I'm happy, relatively happy, with the graphics of the rim site. I'm eagerly and happily looking forward to revising some of those graphics and to doing some modifications of the rim site with its internal dial of the earth plane and the 12 signs. I'm looking forward to doing those minor revisions in the next few weeks so that I can produce a master template for you to use in Celestics. You will want to have the template in a hands-on version, and you will also perhaps want to have the template printed out as a large poster. So ideally, when I finish my revision with the minor adjustment of some star positions in the current rim site model, I'll send out a JPEG. All of you can put that on a memory stick as you wish. Each of you who wishes can put that on a memory stick and take it down to a copy store and have a large poster printed out. So, as I said, when it comes to the graphics of those 13 constellations, I worked and reworked them for many years. And then, of course, in addition to the purely artistic aspect of the rim site zodiac, there was the question of attributing motifs and themes to the 13 constellations. That in itself was quite a massive task. Now, for all future reference, speaking in the jargon of Celestics, and we do love our jargon, we do love our argo, A-R-G-O-T. Speaking in that jargon, I encourage you to use the word inventory to refer to the compilation of myths and legends and all kinds of lore from many cultures, including also some archaeoastronomical, and scientific lore relating to each of the 13 constellations of the zodiac. That's called the inventory. And a good part of what you'll be doing in Celestics is called working the inventory. So in the beginning of the third page of the course on Celestics, I guess that's what this is turning out to be, I will address the question of working the inventory and what that means and how it's to be done. But to return to my long process of trial and error with the constellations, let me just describe to you my situation in L.A. around 1979, after I had been casting charts for 10 years. Remember, January 69 was really when I began. I was living in San Francisco with Jan Kerouac, and I cast our charts, and we pondered over them long and hard with our cat, Wu, sitting on the bed. Now, 10 years later, fast forward, and I was seeing Jan 10 years later. She was with me off and on in L.A. and eventually inherited my apartment in the Hollywood Hills on Sycamore Avenue. During that period, after I had had my encounter with Vili Sukar, I began to work the interface. The interface being signs and constellations. So as I explained, I printed out a graphic, an early graphic form of the rim sight. I cut it into a ring or donut shape, and I glued it around the outside of the horoscopes or teroscopes that I was doing for my clients in L.A. Well, lo and behold, there I had it. I had the juxtaposition of signs which are starless and regular, 30-degree divisions of the Earth plane, and constellations, which are composed of stars, which are irregular in extent, irregular in size. And when I first did that at the end of the 70s, I guarantee you that I didn't have any idea what to make of the intel in the constellations. I just thought that if I put it into the format, that gradually, over time, as I was working with clients and so forth, I would be able to, work out some meanings as some things would just occur to me in the process of reading the biographical material, discussing life events with clients, discussing their complexes and their issues. I thought, well, in that process, maybe something's going to come to light and I'm going to learn how to read the constellations. Now, it's remarkable that anyone in their right mind would even undertake such a course, now that I'm thinking about it. But the remarkable thing is, and I need to register this for you as well, that, and this is really, really beautiful, what I'm going to say now, is that the knowledge and wisdom and insight that you find in the realm of the constellations actually comes from that realm itself. It wells up out of that realm. And so by setting myself up in that way at that time, at the end of the 70s, I did the only thing that I could do at the time, because there was no book that would explain how to interpret planetary positions in the constellations. As you know, I couldn't go to a Vedic or Hindu astrology book because that system will speak of the sun in the constellation of the lion and give you traits and attributes which are taken from sun sign astrology of the sign Leo, which has no stars. And so I knew that I couldn't go to the Vedic system because I would just get a repeat of the sun sign attributes, but attributed to a different sector of the sky, which doesn't make any sense at all. So what I learned was that the wisdom and insight that you need to do celestics and to read Starbase for yourself and other people comes empathically and through observation and contemplation of these sublime figures. Now, there are always two ways to contemplate them. No, there are three ways. One way is to go out and look at the sky and be interactive with the real sky constellations. The second way is to study the RimSight, that particular model. And the third way is to go and research and investigate the many representations of these constellations that have been created over the course of time. So I suggested that you look at Antique Charts of the Sky by Carol Stott, S-T-O-T-T. And there are probably other books available if you search, books that I did not know of and have not encountered, which you would not find in the Ambergain Library. There may be new books illustrating the constellational material. So in those three approaches, you immerse yourself in the constellational material. Now, I intend to impart to you everything that I have already learned about the motifs and themes to be associated with these constellations. I'll explain that in more detail when I talk about developing the inventory in this series of talks from 15 onward. But for right now, just let me reiterate that among those 13 constellations, the one that posed the most difficulty for me was Aquarius, the water bearer. In earlier versions of the RimSight, I called that figure Enki. I associated with Enki for obvious reasons, because Enki was known to be a sailor and to be associated with water. I associated it with some kind of Magian figure, some kind of Persian wizard with a pointed hat and a pointed beard, that sort of thing. In fact, I have a head of the water bearer drawn in that motif somewhere around. I'll see if I can find it and load it up for you. Well, it was with great satisfaction and after much exasperation and confusion that I arrived at the identification of the Manitou constellation as you now have it. And I think this one will hold. In fact, I'm sure this one will hold and will stand up grandly through the ages to come. The Manitou is a guardian and guide figure, both a guardian and a guide, the guardian of the wilderness, the guide to the vision quest. And so, the Mahavidya Matangi has a really special role in the Shakti cluster. Each of the babes in the Shakti cluster is specialized, as you know. And Matangi has a distinctive role because she oversees the planetary vision quest. So what is the planetary vision quest? And it's very fitting, by the way, that I would give this talk on the second day of the Matangi shift of 2014. If the sky clears up, I would expect to see the crescent moon this evening. So, what is the planetary vision quest? And how am I handling that concept in celestics? How am I proposing that you regard that concept in celestics? Well, I ask you to bear with me for a moment here at the 15-minute mark, the quarter way point through this talk, as I'd like to make a reference to something that might seem a little bit remote, but nevertheless I consider it to be extremely relevant. You know, I often speak about romanticism, or the Romantic movement. And you may know by now that the Romantic movement plays a huge role in the background of Planetary Tantra. The particular Mahavidya who oversees the Romantic movement, as it were, is Swan Deva. And I would have you know that correction begins in the Swan Deva shift coming up in March of 2014. Now, as the teacher of Celestics and the Nav in my dual role here, I would strongly suggest that if you are so inclined, you would look into the subject of Romanticism. Now, if you're not inclined, that's okay too, because you're not absolutely going to miss out on something if you don't. But you will have to accept that in the future of Celestics, certain references to Romanticism will be made. So those allusions are part of the teaching process. And if you would like to steep yourself in the background of those allusions, you can do so. Otherwise, just flow with the allusions. There are two books that are essential reading in this area. Now, I have to warn you, these books are very intellectual. And yet, I would also say that there's nothing wrong with being intellectual. Like, I'm an intellectual. That should be obvious by now. The question is not to be an intellectual or not. The question is, can you be an intellectual with heart and passion? So if you're going to be an intellectual, that's the kind that you want to be. Now, these two books, I wouldn't say that they are heavily academically written. I guess they are in a way. But they're not really dry. I mean, they're incredibly rich and full of fantastic insights about the human condition. The first book is Natural Supernaturalism by M.H. Abrams, A-B-R-A-M-S. And this is the single indispensable core book on the subject of Romanticism. Okay? Tradition and Revolution in Romantic Literature. I'm sure it's required reading in all college courses on Romanticism and the humanities. The only problem is they don't teach humanities in colleges anymore, do they? Okay, in the second book, which is beautifully written and deeply explored book, deeply researched, is The Romantic Conception of Life by Robert J. Richards. And this was published by the University of Chicago Press in 92, I guess. Now, this book contains a lot about Goethe, and it has the wonderful chapter called The Erotic Authority of Nature. I just love that phrase. The Erotic Authority of Nature. So these are two books on Romanticism that you might sink your teeth into, and if you do, I would advise that you take a really long time to read them. Read them slowly, savor them, don't tear through them rapidly, and contemplate and consider the richness of the material as it comes to you page by page and chapter by chapter. Now, why am I bringing up Romanticism in reference to the planetary vision quest? Good question. Well, the answer to that question, or one answer, the answer that I would choose to present to you now, can be found in a book I hold in my hand from the Ambergane Collection. This book is entitled Reflections on the Philosophy of the History of Mankind. And the author is Johann Gottfried von Herder. Von Herder, H-E-R-D-E-R. Now, who was von Herder? Well, he was a German philosopher, a theologian, and a poet, and a critic of literature, a philologist, who stands sort of between the Romantic movement at the end of the 18th century and the so-called Enlightenment. So von Herder was born in 1744 and died in 1803. I identify the central vortex moment of the Romantic movement as 1820. So he was a little prior to the key moment, the central defining moment of the Romantic movement. He was a predecessor. He was a groundbreaker. And it's highly significant, indeed, that von Herder was born in 1744. Because I calculate that it was around that time, 1740s into the 1750s, about 30 years before the American Revolution, that the Aeon Sophia began to awake into her lucid dream of human history, which is what we call the nightmare of history. And as I've said, her first dreaming identity is reflected in the character of Justine in the writings of the Marquis de Sade. So von Herder was born practically at the moment that the Aeon Sophia started to become lucid. Highly significant. Now, in this book I have in my hand, there's a particular chapter, and the heading of the chapter reads like this. Humanity is the end of human nature, and with this end, God has put their own fate into the hands of mankind. Okay? Now, this statement from Herder in his Philosophical Reflections resonates strongly with the concern of the Romantics. A whole crew of Romantics were obsessed with this particular issue, which is basically how humanity could take control of history and, as it were, write its own script. And so they were looking into the narrative structures of history. They were looking at history and historical events going all the way back to ancient times and treating it as a narrative structure, which it is, because history is just a narrative. The events are the events, but history is not the events, is it? History is a story about the events. And they understood that deeply. So they understood that this story of history appears at first to be something that we inherit. But then at a certain point, von Herder was asking, and numerous other Romantics as well, like Schelling, were asking, well, wait, at a certain moment, doesn't the script of history become a self-fulfilling prophecy? Don't we take over the narrative at a certain point? Can we see what these people were getting at? Of course, they didn't have the Sophianic narrative of the mysteries. But they were speculating about how they would behave if they did have it. I mean, isn't that wild? Unfortunately, what they did have as a transcendental narrative for framing historical events was the Judeo-Christian narrative of history and salvationism. And so, unfortunately, von Herder and all of his contemporaries, and even such wild-eyed tantric visionaries and revolutionaries such as William Blake himself, all of these wild-eyed Romantics were shackled and hampered terribly by the Judeo-Christian narrative of history, which, of course, paints Christianity as the greatest thing since sliced bread, and which is deeply infected with the Messianic virus and the Zadokite virus and so forth. And they didn't have an alternative because Gnosticism was still buried in a cave in southern Egypt. And they did not have access to the correct, to the necessary sources that would give them the correct direction in which to undertake the history of humanity. Yet they were deeply inspired out of the endopsyche at that moment on the planet, deeply inspired to do just that. They were deeply inspired to undertake the writing of history as, let's call it, a project of creative mythology, you see? And indeed, the origins of creative mythology and everything that Joseph Campbell proposed in the book of that name, which is one of the four books in the Masks of God series, and everything that culminated in the comparative mythology of the 20th century has its roots in the middle of the 18th century, in the beginning of the Romantic movement. And so Herder was a key figure in defining the quest for a narrative. Let's call it that. Another point that you don't want to miss about Herder, which is truly remarkable, is that he shared the views of another German thinker, a naturalist and philosopher named Wilhelm von Humboldt. He shared the views that language actually determines the way we think rather than the other way around. And you may or may not know that this theory or proposition has been revived in the 20th century. It's called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, Sapir-Whorf. Well, whatever the specifics of that hypothesis, I'm pretty sure that you could put the proposition in plain English the way I did many, many years ago teaching in Santa Fe. I saw my students struggling in the class to articulate themselves and to put their concepts into words. So it was as if they were thinking of something. We were talking about astrology and the methodology of the astrological chart and so forth. This would have been the Terra Astrology course. They were thinking about something, and they were struggling to find the words to express their thought, and I said, no, that's not what's happening at all. You can think as clearly as you can express your thinking in words. So the words come first, the language comes first, as I've indicated in introducing Celestics to you. So the notion that language determines thinking originated with the Romantics, and a number of them, including von Herder, were deeply involved with the question of the power of language, that is to say, syntax and expression in verbal form and in written form. And they tackled those problems, those deep technical problems and psychological problems, because they were dedicated to the search for a narrative. Why do I bring up Herder and his reflections on the philosophy of the history of humankind? Because it is the deep background of the planetary vision quest. I can proudly and happily tell you that we today have what the Romantics were seeking. More accurately, I would say what they were blindly groping for. They began to blindly grope for a way to control the narrative at the very time that the Ansophia was awaking into a lucid dream wherein she is able to incorporate into her syntax as an aeon the course of human history, which is not an aeonic activity, but completely and entirely a product of the human species. So the quest among the Romantics from 1750 onward to own the narrative of humanity, as von Herder says, came from the inspiration of her awakening. Can you see that? And we today, at a trajectory of 1850, 1950, 2000, 264 years later from 1750, we have the method to own the narrative. And we have the narrative for the entire planet. The narrative that is the story of the planet. And the rule in the universe is one story to a planet. Please. You know, if you're an individual person, human creature walking around on two legs, and you have more than one story going for your history, that's called multiple personality disorder. Now, unless you have mastery of certain imaginative techniques and certain storytelling techniques that would allow you to speak of yourself as if you had lived in other times, in previous times, that would allow you to speak in a quasi-fictional manner of your previous lives, then it's not healthy for you to have more than one identity running. You have to be an artist of fictional identities to have more than one identity running in a way that isn't sick. And it is sick and dangerous to be a multiple personality, to have multiple personality disorder. I know, I just recently encountered someone who has that disorder. As three distinct personalities running. Certainly they merge and they blend into each other, but they are also in conflict with each other, and each of those personalities is in turn in conflict with itself. Now that's a scenario for you. So there is one story for the planet Earth. There is one biography for the planetary animal mother, just one. She doesn't have multiple personality disorder. And let's not give it to her by inflicting upon her a series of extraneous narratives that cannot be tested against the witnessing of her own intelligence. Okay? Now, to bring this subject around to Celestics, let me first indicate what aspects of the planetary vision quest, that is to say, undertaking the narrative of the planet, do not belong to Celestics. There are some aspects of the planetary vision quest that belong to planetary tantra, obviously, and there are specific aspects that belong to Celestics. So I want you to see the difference, and then you can mix and match them to your liking, okay? But you need to see the difference and you need to establish some clear boundaries of definition. In the frame of planetary tantra, the planetary vision quest denotes A, observing and living the sacred narrative of the Aeon Sophia, her true story. B, uniting your life with the power of the Shakti cluster. C, discovering your personal guardian within the ranks of the Shakti cluster among the Mahavidyas and Diamond Sky Dakinis. That can be done with a rite of courting, by the way. And four, undertaking a rite of passage or wilderness quest for the purpose of making the Gayan Tantric vow. And there's probably a fifth and a sixth, but you see the point that I'm getting at. To be involved with planetary tantra puts you on the planetary vision quest. Why? Well, because you have the planetary vision as your directive narrative. But within that vision, which is the life story of the mother planet herself, there are endless parameters of adventure and discovery for each human animal. The only requirement is to passionately love her story and be faithful to the story. Stay in the story. Do not embellish or facetiously or speciously elaborate the narrative. Now, I've been elaborating the narrative along with you for several years now. In my book, Not in His Image, I present FGS 1.0, that is the minimal form of the restored narrative of the Aeon Sophia from the Levantine Mysteries. That is the 1.0 version. Then you've seen how that 1.0 has been extrapolated and developed, expanded and enriched into 2.0. Currently we're in 3.0. And as correction begins, we enter FGS 4.0. It's an upgrade of the fallen goddess scenario, coming right up to correction. And there would probably be a 5, not that far down the road. But let me just state for the record that in March of 2014, with the reset completed, those of us in Planetary Tantra can be confident that we are working with FGS 4.0. So owning, living, loving, and delighting in the Sophianic narrative is your way to be on the vision quest. And within that engagement, within that participation, there are other particular things that you can do consistent with the quest. As I just said, you can do a rite of courting to identify who is your particular guardian in the Shakti cluster. You can also assume your place in the ranks of the Kalika War Party. It's really important to be specific with the syntax of the narrative. Why? Because language determines thought. The language that you use, the language that you learn in Celestics, is the same as the language that you learn in the GNE and Planetary Tantra. It is a language that determines how you can think about the subject matter. You can think as well as you can express your thinking in words. Do you see the point of that message? That is a maieutic trick. Now, the second way, another way to pursue the planetary vision quest is to do the Gaian Tantric Vow. Now, you may do that on a wilderness quest if you like. You could go out with a friend and trek into the woods and stay overnight or stay a few nights, and in some glorious and pristine place in nature, you could perform the Gaian Tantric Vow and invoke the Dakinis and the spirits of the Shakti cluster, those infernal bitches, those emanations of the Aeon Sophia. That would be a way, in this day and age, in the 21st century, to reenact the motif of the vision quest, which is a universal motif in all indigenous cultures on the planet. Go look it up. Go read about it in Mershe Eliade. Read about it in his book on shamanism, groundbreaking book of the 1950s. The vision quest. The vision quest of the Australian Aborigines is called a walkabout. The vision quest of the North American Indians involved fasting and going into the wilderness for several days until the guardian of the wilderness, variously named, appeared. What is the generic name for the guardian of the wilderness? The Manitou. The Manitou appears often in the form of a power animal. The purpose of the vision quest, as explained in Black Elk Speaks, which is a famous classic cited in the Seeker's Handbook, is twofold. First, to contact your power animal, and second, to have a vision to bring back to the community and the tribe. The vision that you have while you're in the wilderness, outside of society, gives you the direction that you can take when you return to society. And those two elements, when they were achieved, would prove that the Vision Quest had been successful. The Vision Quest had to be undertaken for those two objectives. Can you see that? And you can do the same thing today. Although you could say that perhaps the objective of the second objective, to return to society from the wilderness with a sense of responsibility and mission and with a confidence of your role in the social order, could now be replaced. It could be upgraded and replaced. One way that that could be done is to take your place in the ranks of the Calico War Party, okay? But another way, and here's where we come around to Celestics, another way to know your role and your mission in the world and to know how humanity lives through you is to read it in the intel of Starbase, drawing from the manifold and drawing from the positions of the manifold, sun, moon, earth, and planets, and lunar nodes, and asteroid Chiron, and lunar apogee and perigee. That's the manifold. The position of the manifold in the 13 constellations. That is your guide. That is your formula, your recipe, as it were, for your role in the world. What you came here to do. Your transcendental purpose as a human animal can be read in Starbase. And so we'll see how Celestics, which you are now undertaking, is an accessory to the planetary vision quest. It's a tool for guidance in that quest. And everyone uses the tool in the same way, and the results of the tool are the same for everyone. That is to say, the objective is universal. Everyone who uses the tool of Celestics is seeking the same result, right? And so, not only can you share the process of discovery and learning that takes you to that result, but you can share the results. And the results will be very diverse, because we each have a very specific purpose to achieve on this planet within the framework of the sacred narrative. That is to say, we all have a purpose to achieve in the framework of her life, because you don't have a life of your own when you enter planetary tantra. You don't have a life of your own anymore. Yet, paradoxically, the life that you do have, that you call your own, your personal life, acquires another dimension of power, of beauty, of meaning, if you will, but more specifically, of purpose and direction. And this is exactly what everyone is looking for. I learned this from my years of astrological practice with hundreds and hundreds of clients. And I think I said at the beginning of these talks that it was quite a humbling realization for me to come to that point. I was, you could say, I think you could venture to say, I could venture to say, without sounding arrogant, a fairly accomplished astrologer. Some of my readings, as it were, some of my consultations, exhibited a skill in psychological profiling that was positively staggering. It was not uncommon for me to sit down with a client in the balcony office in Santa Fe, and then later on during my visits to Dallas and to LA and to upstate New York. It was not uncommon for me to sit there with clients, people who were totally unknown to me, and within 20 minutes we would be deep into a discussion of the most intimate issues and details of that individual's life, sometimes at the point of tears. 20 minutes. Right to the chase. This is what an accomplished astrologer can do. Nevertheless, it was extremely humbling for me to admit that even though I could do that, not always, believe me, but on some good occasions, on a good day, I could really score. Even so, I could not tell that individual the one burning question above all others. I could not answer the one burning question. Why am I here? What is my purpose? And accessory to that question, the second question, what are my innate talents and gifts? And now I can tell you that those questions are answerable and you can answer them in Celestics. And the way to do that is not difficult. So it's my intention on page 3 of these talks, 15 through 21, to lay out the foundations of the method and the practice and the way that we do it. And I suspect that on page 4, from lesson 22 onward, we can move into examples and illustrations, and I can demonstrate for you how to read Starbase. So in undertaking Celestics, you need to be really clear that you are on a path that does not merely benefit you, but benefits everyone else who's learning this with you. And those people in times to come, those people that you will meet in the future of your life, to whom you can give purpose and direction through this method. So the Planetary Vision Quest is alive and well in Celestics. And the language and insights to be gained are boundless. They're boundless. You know, one of the things that distinguishes Celestics and even my use of ASB, which is astrology for Starbase, that is to say, even my starless sun sign format, distinguishes those methods from conventional astrology is that they are not cookbook methods. So you're not going to do Starbase or ASB, astrology for Starbase, by cookbook methods. You cannot pursue the Planetary Vision Quest by a cookbook method, okay? What is a cookbook method? Well, that's the traditional way that you learn astrology, and unfortunately, it's the way that many astrologers practice astrology. So if you went back to the heyday of the astrological movement in the 70s, in the mid-70s, for instance, you would find countless books published at that time. Books by Robert Hand, by Alan Oaken, by Akerin Sikoyan. I can't remember all the names now. I have a ton of them down in the Ambergene Library in the astrological corner. They're all down there. Not so much books by Rudyard because he wasn't a cookbook astrologer. A cookbook is, for instance, Planets in Houses by Robert Hand. You open it up and what do you get? You get sections that say first house, okay? Mercury in the first house, Venus in the first house, Moon in the first house, Mars in the first house, and so forth. And then it gives you a paragraph, a description for what to say when your client has Mars in the first house or Saturn in the 10th house or Uranus in the 12th house, such as I have in my chart. Okay? And so there you go. It's like that's a cookbook. And then you take the other book, well, Planets in Aspects, okay? Mars square Uranus, and you read this. And what you do is you compile phrases from the cookbooks and you put them in a blender, and what comes out of that is supposed to be a valid astrology reading. Well, in Celestics, we don't do the intel by cookbooks. We do it in a much more playful way, in an interactive way. I have always applied the principle that I teach what I am learning. Of course, to a certain extent, I teach what I already know. I mean, obviously. Look at Celestics. I'm teaching a lot that I already know. But when it comes to the actual material and the inventory, when it comes to actually putting into language the purpose and direction of human life, there is no cookbook that is going to get you there. And so you learn how to do it as you go along, and you teach what you're learning. And you are all teachers to each other. This is a team effort. You are all teachers to each other in Celestics. And the joy of it is that it has a synergetic power and richness precisely because that is the collaboration. That is what makes it work. Clear enough? Now, in the closing 10 minutes or so of this talk, let me bring your attention to a factor of Celestics, which I consider to be extremely beautiful. And it is a unique factor in my own course of study of astrology down through the years. I wrote about this factor in Quest for the Zodiac, and I call it biographic empathy. And what is biographic empathy? Well, obviously, it means having empathy not just for another human animal, another person, not just having empathy for, you know, something that happened to them, whether it be good or bad, but to have empathy for their biography, to have empathy for their life story. When I undertook the jump of juxtaposing signs with constellations, I had no idea how to read the content of the constellations, as I've said. And one way that I undertook that challenge was in biographical studies. Now, it's true that I picked up on the trick of biographical studies to some degree from Willy Sucker, because he had done studies of famous people from the past. Now, due to Sucker's perspective, due to his mindset, and his involvement with the work of Rudolf Steiner, he had blinders on when it came to choosing the case studies and case histories that he examined. So, almost without exception, the people that Willy Sucker studied by casting their birth data were in some way or another referred to anthroposophy, or they had been people named by Rudolf Steiner as being of interest, people of interest. Now, I myself was already on that track before I met Sucker. You might recall that I said that I left a peachy scene that I had, and a peachy woman indeed, in Santa Fe, to go to L.A., specifically to investigate the lectures entitled Karmic Relationships, given by Rudolf Steiner at the end of his life. And I wanted to know if it would be possible to cast, as an astrologer, to cast the charts of the people he cited in Karmic Relationships, and to validate or verify their karmic and reincarnational links by astrological means. So I already had the germ of that idea in my mind. So I was geared toward biographical research. My precious time with Willy Sucker reconfirmed and enforced that orientation. So my incentive to undertake biographical studies was strong. And from the late 70s onward, I proceeded to cast the charts of many, many famous people. And these charts and the records and compilations of them that I made are all in the Ambergain archives. They need to be cleaned up and put together in some kind of intelligible form and formatted in a consistent way. But they're all there, and I would contend that there's a great deal to be learned from those materials. But of course, they could be expanded even further today, given that we accept to use IT as a technique in Celestics, as a tool. And that's a question that I want to address a little further on as I get into techniques and tools in the third set of talks. But for right now, I just want to point out that you can work the inventory by looking at, but by researching and compiling all kinds of material relative to each of the 13 constellations. It's as if you had a studio, a big warehouse studio, and against one wall you had a shelf, and on this shelf there were 13 boxes, open boxes. And you put into each of those boxes the literary or artistic material that was relevant to that constellation, whether it be the ram, the scales, the snake tamer, or whatever. So you would collect a series of images from all around the world referring to the snake tamer. You would collect textual references in ancient mythography and even in literature, and wherever you would find the materials that would fit thematically with that constellation, you would compile that material. That is how you work the inventory. But there's also a special way of working the inventory along biographical lines. And the way that you do that is that you do starbase format for some famous person that you admire. For instance, take the dancer Isadora Duncan or the dancer, Russian dancer Nijinsky. I did this with both Isadora Duncan and Nijinsky. But let's just take Nijinsky, who danced the Rite of Spring for Igor Stravinsky's orchestration and so forth, okay? Who went insane at the end of his life, who wrote a very interesting book when he was in an insane asylum in Switzerland. So what do? You read Nijinsky's book. You always read what the people themselves, the subject of your study, has written, if they have written anything. And then you read a really good biography of Nijinsky. And that's not always easy to find, because there are numerous biographies of famous artists and writers and scientists and dancers and whatever. And sometimes these biographies are really bad. So you have to kind of develop a nose for a good biography. So let's say you have Nijinsky's memoir. I forgot what it's called. It's a small, short book of some 75, 80 pages. And then you have a good biography about Nijinsky. And then you have a really good cup of tea or coffee or a margarita or whatever you like. And you sit there in the corner on a beautiful winter evening with a fire going, with your starbase charts out. And you read about the life of this person and you keep looking at the starbase and looking at the manifold. And then you read and you look and you read and you look. And things come up. And you see how the intel comes alive by associations and allusions that clearly appear in the life of this person. So you learn to add meaning to the manifold drawn from actual biographic case studies. And that is the art of biographic empathy. I demonstrated that in Quest for the Zodiac. Of course, biographic empathy also applies among yourselves. You can trade your starbase intel, compare it with each other, talk to each other, either face-to-face, or if not, talk on Skype, and share the intel. And every insight that you have about another individuals, Starbase, adds and enriches your insight into yourself. So this is a tremendously abundant field that you're entering. And it's important for me to lay out the parameters so that you can approach this field with confidence and not feel overwhelmed and swamped going in. So I intend to do that in the upcoming series of talks after the following talk, which deals with a troublesome topic. And the title of the 14th talk, the last talk on page 2, is Archontic DOS and the Planetary System.